It's basically zero almost everywhere except at a point on the x-y plane. And in this limit, basically there's no longer any classical dynamics because the electron just feels no force. But at the quantum level, if you consider a bunch of incoming electrons and you ask what is the cross-section for these electrons to scatter off the solenoid, you do find a non-zero answer, and this is what Harrenhoff and Bohm discovered. And the fundamental reason here is that at the quantum level, it is what, even though the magnetic field is zero everywhere except at the point, it's really the mu, the vector potential, that matters. And what you find is that the vector potential is non-zero outside the solenoid. There's another piece of physics that is worth noting here, which is that if you stare at this answer over here for the scattering cross-section, you discover that it is a periodic function of this combination, this product of charge times the magnetic flux, which I'm going to call the Harrenhoff-Bohm phase. And I claim that this periodic dependence on the Harrenhoff-Bohm phase is a reflection of the topological nature of this Harrenhoff-Bohm interaction. And to understand what I mean here, what I mean by topological, let me phrase this problem in a slightly different manner, which is that instead of asking what the scattering cross-section is, let me ask instead, what is the quantum mechanical amplitude for an electrically charged particle to propagate from some position x prime to some position x? And we know actually the answer is given by a path integral that you see over here, which tells us that the quantum mechanical amplitude for propagating from x prime to x is simply given by the sum of all possible paths. I was told not to do that because the guy recording the talk will not be able to see anyone in the limit as the photon density go to zero. So coming back to what I was saying, the quantum mechanical amplitude for propagating from x prime to x is simply given by the sum of all possible paths joining x prime to x, weighted by this exponential over here. And particularly the electromagnetic interaction term tells us that as far as the electromagnetism is concerned, the paths that join x prime to x, can be broken down into an infinite but discrete set of classes, and that's why we call it the topological interaction, such that different paths that belong to different classes are characterized by the fact that they cannot be continuously deformed into each other without passing through the solenoid. And the main point here is that paths that cannot be continuously deformed into each other will give you will contribute to the quantum mechanical amplitude with a phase difference that goes like the exponential of some integer multiple of the Harrenhoff-Bohm phase. For example, these two paths that I drew over here will give you one multiple of the AB phase. And for example, these two paths will give you a phase difference that goes like twice the AB phase, and so on. And since this guy over here is obviously periodic in the Harrenhoff-Bohm phase, therefore, as you can see, therefore you can see why I advertised earlier that it is the topological nature of this interaction that gives us this periodicity. So likewise, as we go to the field theory case and calculate the pair production rate, we would expect that this periodic dependence to continue to hold. So let's come back to the problem at hand. Remember, we have a solenoid, and I'm going to shake it, and I'm going to calculate what the pair production rate would be. And at the theoretical level, it turns out that the description of this setup can be broken down into two parts. One is just standard quantum electrodynamics, and here we're going to consider both the bosonic case as well as the fermionic case. And then the second part of the description involves the dynamics of the flux tube itself. And here we're going to borrow an effective theory that was written down by Mark Alford and Frank Wilczek in 1989. And they tell us that basically, if you have a magnetic flux tube, its action can be simply written down as the total flux through the tube multiplied by what I'm going to call the dual or the Maxwell tensor, integrated on the world sheet swept out by your flux tube. And so now we have the theory specified and we can start doing some calculations. But let's first sort of back up a little bit and ask ourselves, why should we expect particle production to occur? And the reason is quite simple, actually. The reason is it just comes down to the fact that around a moving solenoid, the gauge potential has to be necessarily time dependent. And in fact, in a particular gauge, you can write down the solution exactly, and it looks like this. C is the trajectory of your solenoid on the x-axis, but is otherwise arbitrary. And if you remember our Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian of our quantum field theory would contain a term containing the coupling of A mu to the electric current. Therefore, since A mu is time dependent, our Hamiltonian is therefore also necessarily time dependent, which means that because now we have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, it may not commute with itself at different times. And that further implies that the zero particle state within the Heisenberg picture at different times is not necessarily the same vector. If you put it differently, it means that if you start out from the zero particle state, say in the asymptotic past, you will find that it would have a non-zero overlap with the multi-particle states of the theory at some later time. Or in other words, if you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, generically you do expect particle creation to occur. So the first scheme that I'm going to employ to do my pair production rate calculation is what we call the moving frame scheme. And in spirit, it's akin to the adiabatic approximation that we use in quantum mechanics. So let me just describe what we really do. And what we really do is basically you solve the Klein-Gordon equation for the case of the scalar, and you solve the Dirac equation for the case of the fermion for first the case of a stationary solenoid. And once you've obtained the eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian, that's what we call the mode functions, then you shift these mode functions so that they're now centered at the instantaneous location of the moving solenoid. And with these as our basis functions, you can then do an expansion for your quantum operators in terms of these mode functions. And that's what these two sums are. The F and the H's are the mode functions for the scalars, U and V's for the fermions, and A and B are just the usual creation and annihilation operators for the scalar and fermionic particles. And so with this expansion in place, then you can go ahead and calculate what the zero particle to two particle transition amplitude is. That's what pair production means. And of course, if you can solve the evolution operator exactly, then this is your answer. But usually that's rarely possible. So perturbatively, that's what we'll end up computing. And let's see some results. These are the scalar results. Because we have really an infinite solenoid, the pair production rate is really a pair production rate per unit length of the solenoid. So here the K and the KZs are the outgoing radial and the Z momentum of the scalar particle. But what's most important to note here is that you see this pair production rate result is dependent on the Aharonov-Bohm phase through this kappa, which is the phase over 2 pi modulo 1, which means to say the rate result that we're getting is manifestly periodic in the Aharon of Bone Face, which again, as I've advertised earlier, is because of this topological nature of the interaction.
What is theta? Is that a step?
Yes. Is it just an energy conservation? You can't go below a certain threshold. And then for the fermionic results, here I've kept the dependence on the momentum of the fermion, which is the k, as well as that for the anti-fermions, the k primes. And again, we see this periodicity on the AB phase. And one other thing that we want to note here is that the rates here are for both the scalar, and the fermions, you see that the rate is proportional to V naught squared, which suggests that this is a perturbative in V result, and therefore really non-relativistic. And so if you want a relativistic result, but are willing to assume that now that the Aharonov-Bohm phase itself is small, then you can get a fully relativistic result by simply evaluating these pair of Feynman diagrams. The crossover here simply comes from the Feynman rules that you get from the flux tube action, and the rest of the diagrams simply come from the standard quantum rules of quantum electrodynamics. For example, the wavy line is the photon propagator, the outgoing states are plane waves, and the vertex that you see here is just the coupling between the vector potential and the electric current. And it doesn't take a lot of work to write down the form of the zero particle to two particle transition amplitude. The P here that you see, so the first form that of the amplitude is manifestly Lorentz invariant. The P, as I was saying, P is the sum of the outgoing momentum of the particle and antiparticle. J is the electric current, and S alpha beta is, roughly speaking, some sort of Fourier transform on the world sheet of your flux tube. And it will always turn out that this guy can always be factored into two independent integrals that I'm going to call I plus and I minus. And it's worth pointing out that this form of the amplitude actually is valid for any flux tube trajectory. But in particular, if you look at our moving solenoid case, what you find is that the spatial part of the cross product between I plus and I minus will turn out to be an infinite sum over an infinite set of harmonics, where the sum of the outgoing energies of the particle and antiparticle will be some integer multiple of the oscillation frequency of our solenoid. And here you see that the occurrence of V naught inside a Bessel function tells you now that the is now a non-perturbative in V calculation because it's fully relativistic.
Here that this is the adiabatic approximation?
No, the adiabatic approximation, that was just because we are really taking the stationary solenoid solutions and shifting them, right, and assuming that this forms a good basis. And so it's not surprising that it's a non-relativistic approximation, because if you shake it very hard, if you shake it very fast, then you can't expect your adiabatic approximations to work well. I mean, it's like solving a square well, but changing the size of the square well or moving a square well around. If you shake your square well around very much, this is in quantum mechanics, and you can't expect the stationary square well solutions to work well as your basis functions. That was a long detour. But in this case, we are completely forgetting about solving the mode functions exactly around some background, but rather just treating, now what we're basically treating is the string itself, the tube itself, as a perturbation. Right, and so this part of the diagram basically is telling you what is the A mu sourced by this perturbation, and then correspondingly calculating the pair production rate. Does that answer your question?
So you're saying that you didn't invent any mode.
Yeah.
This is true for any mode. So we didn't assume a particular, we didn't solve for the mode functions here.
Right, because that's
why I brought up the fact that we're treating the string now as a perturbation. Yeah. Okay. So with this i plus cross i minus, now that brings us to the second form of the amplitude. And in fact, and one thing I want to point out here is that if you remember that the current in the fermionic case contains information about the spin of the outgoing fermions. It shouldn't surprise you, since this is a J dotted into some vector, that there's now some sort of special direction that's picked out by this cross product here, as well as the momentum of the individual outgoing particles, such that the spins of your E plus E minus, the fermion anti-fermion, is anti-correlated along the special direction. The actual expression for this direction is kind of cumbersome, so I'm leaving that out. But it shouldn't surprise you that there is one. And so the results are as follows. We have both the bosons and the fermions. And again, it is a pair production rate per unit length. And in this case, I left it out of the integration, so it's per unit phase space as well. And they look very similar, except for the numerator that you see over here. And the reason is quite simple, and it comes down to... Yes? So
that rate is not periodic in E5.
Right, right. So, which is why I emphasize this on every slide, which is that this is the limit where the phase itself is assumed to be small. Or another way to put it is, like I said, we're treating the flux tube itself as a perturbation. Yeah. And yes, and so I was saying that the reason why only the numerator matters differs is because the only difference between the bosonic amplitude and the fermionic amplitude comes in the form of J. Everything else is the same. And so let's look at some plots. If you ask what is the total power in the form of just emitted particles, you find that even as you take the high frequency limit, in other words, if you shake your solenoid so fast, so hard, that its frequency is basically so large that M can be set to zero, even in this limit, you find that as you go to higher and higher harmonics, unless you are moving also at a relativistic speed, otherwise, the emitted power basically gets damped out exponentially. So this is the first harmonic when the sum of the energies are equals to omega. This is twice omega, and so on. Then the other question that you can ask is, what's the emitted pattern like? What's the angular distribution of the outgoing particles? And so if you take a take a high frequency limit and look at the relativistic case as well, and now look at just emission in the xy plane with the momentum equal, what you find is that the top row is bosons and the bottom row is fermions. What you find is that at the lowest harmonic, this is L equals to 1, the emitted emission pattern is quite different between fermions and bosons. The x-axis is the azimuthal angle of the outgoing particle, and the y, the azimuthal angle for the antiparticle. So for the bosonic case, it's peaked at two spots on the plane, whereas for the fermions, there's this bend, which tells you that actually it's the emission is peaked whenever the angles are supplementary. But as you go to higher and higher harmonics, say by the time you get to L equals to 10, what you find is that there is a similarity emerging, which is that the plots are now peaked at the corners and the edges, which means that the peak emission in the xy plane is when the angles are either both zero or both pi, which means that there's now a beaming effect. The particles are emitted highly beamed at high energies along the direction of motion of the solenoid itself.
Sir,
yes?
About the coordinate here. So both coordinates are angles?
Yes. Y, the x-axis is the azimuthal angle, so angle with respect to the x-axis of the particle, and for the y-axis is the angle with respect to the x-axis of the antiparticle. So like I was saying, you know, you have a peak over here, roughly in the center of the plot, which means that the particle will come out at pi, and the antiparticle will also come out at pi, which is backward, you know, along the x-axis, negative x-axis. Yeah. Okay, so that brings me actually to the second part of my talk.
Before you switch,
yes.
I missed the first
sure,
minutes. So
sure.
Just so I understand the implication of what you did, that the picture was you have the solenoid and you're shaking it sinusoidally.
Right.
And omega, capital omega was the frequency of that shaking?
Exactly.
And what was V naught?
V naught was the amplitude of the, so the trajectory is V naught over omega sine omega t. That's the trajectory. So the second part of my talk is going to be about the n-body problem in general relativity. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about how I've tried to tackle this problem using techniques usually associated with perturbative quantum field theory. So let me begin by saying, what do I mean by the n-body problem? What I have in mind is that I have an astrophysical system of an arbitrary number of compact objects that are bound by their mutual gravity. So these can be planets going around the sun, can be neutron star systems, black holes, etc. And what I want to ask is I want to ask if I can write down an effective Lagrangian that describes their gravitational interaction. And I was, as I've already said, I'm going to assume that these are compact objects, which means that the typical sizes of these objects are very small relative to the typical separation distances. And in that limit, I can say, therefore, that these compact objects are basically point particles. And therefore, the n-body problem would reduce down to describing the dynamics of the coordinates of these point particles. And if I also further assume that this is a non-relativistic system, then the n-body problem for me reduces down to computing the corrections to Newtonian gravity that you see over here coming from general relativity. And schematically, it's really a power series expansion in V over C squared, where V is the typical speed of these compact objects. I should say there are odd powers in V whenever you talk about, when you include effects like rotation and radiation and so on, but for the purpose of my talk, I'm only going to talk about the V over C squared terms. And the other thing that is worthwhile to introduce at this point is that there is a nomenclature in the general relativity community which says that if you're working at the V to the 2Q order in perturbation theory, that's called the Q-th post-Newtonian order. Now, the n-body problem in GR is a little bit more complicated than, say, the n-body problem in, say, classical electrodynamics. And the reason is that GR, as we all know, is very nonlinear, highly nonlinear, and so superposition does not hold. In particular, even if you know the two-body Lagrangian up to very high order, that doesn't tell you much about the n-body, the full expression for the n-body Lagrangian. If you look at the literature, actually it turns out that the n-body problem is quite well known at first order in V squared. It even has a name called the Einstein-Infeld-Hoffmann Lagrangian. And if you read Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, for example, it will tell you that the equations of motion at first order are regularly used to compute solar system dynamics. For example, the precession of Mercury's perihelion begins at this order. But if you look at the second order results, however, actually it's only known partially. And in particular, I'm going to describe to you today how I've tried to tackle this calculation using field theory techniques. But before you start a second order calculation, you want to ask yourself why you want to do it in the first place, other than if you're just being a masochist. And for me, there are two main reasons that got me into this calculation. And the first has to do with the fact that I think we're beginning to plan for experiments, usually in the form of laser ranging satellites and observatories, that will begin to probe the non-Euclidean nature of the solar system's geometry beyond the first order in V squared. So you might ask me, what has geometry got to do with the dynamics that we're computing here? And the answer is that because this is a gravitational interaction, these two things are intimately tied together. And to see this, suppose you have the n-body Lagrangian. Someone calculated it and gave it to you. And now consider adding a test particle to it. Now, if you have the n-body Lagrangian, adding a test particle is trivial. But because it's a test particle, meaning its mass is very small relative to the other mass in the system, the other masses in the system, which means that its effective Lagrangian has to take on exactly this form, because you know in this small mass limit, test mass limit, it has to be moving. This test particle has to be moving along a geodesic in the space-time metric generated by the rest of its counterparts in the system. And in particular, if you're doing a flat space expansion, as we are doing in this problem, then once you have the effective Lagrangian, essentially you can read off the deviation from flat space by reading off the effective Lagrangian result. The second motivation that got me into this calculation is actually related more to the two-body part of the calculation. And the goal here is that to try to push perturbation theory to as high an order as possible. And again, this is related to experimental probes of general relativity. In this case, it's to do with the current very large worldwide effort to try to detect gravitational waves coming from astrophysical binaries, neutron stars, black holes giving off gravitational waves as they orbit around each other. And it turns out detectors like LIGO and Virgo would first, in order to detect these waves, would first need to construct theoretical templates of these gravitational waveforms, and then use these templates to integrate against their raw data to search for correlations. And because these detectors are expected to trace the evolution of the phase of these waveforms up to something like 10,000 cycles, you need very accurate templates to do the job. And because the construction of these templates are based on our knowledge of the two-body problem in GR, we need to calculate the two-body dynamics up to very high order. In fact, within GR, the calculation has been pushed up to 3.5 PM at the present time.
Including spin or
not? I thought so. No, in fact, now the two sides, the Ira and Raphael has done this, I thought so. Yeah. Let me check on this, but that's my impression. And then the GR side also has been done, I thought. And in fact, I was at Columbia, and there was a relativist there who told me that even on the experimental side, they have already incorporated the spin effects into the templates, the template banks. Yeah. So that's my impression. But let me check on that, so don't quote me on it, but that's my impression. But so you might ask me, so since the GR calculation itself has been pushed to such a high order already, and why bother to use a new method? Why introduce quantum field theory? And the reason here is that starting at the third order, at V to the sixth, the GR calculation itself began to encounter divergences due to the point particle approximation that's being used here. And in fact, these divergences that they encountered were eventually handled by invoking a dimensional regularization, which, as many of you might know here, is a staple tool of perturbative quantum field theory, especially when dealing with gauge symmetries, like the ones that we have in gravity. So we see that to push perturbation theory to high orders, you need a systematic framework to handle the necessary regularization and renormalization that you will encounter. And that's exactly what field theory offers you. But not only that, as I will describe to you, it offers you a very systematic computational algorithm as well. You first need to do some dimensional analysis, figure out what Feynman diagrams you need, but after that, you just crank through some integrals, and that gives you your dynamics.
So below 3bn, there's no divergences to?
No. Yeah, so up to the second order than calculating, not really. There are intermediate steps where you might get integrals that diverge by themselves, but at the end of the day, no, the final result does not have any divergence.
But what's the reason for the divergence to appear at 3pn?
Yeah, the fundamental reason has to do with the point particle approximation. So having a delta function in your stress energy tensor is, I believe, strictly speaking, ill-defined in a nonlinear theory like GR. So if you write down, G mu nu, capital G mu nu equals to T mu nu, and I think you're allowed to have one delta function in G mu nu, but no, I think two is marginal. I have to, my impression is that, because that's what the string is. But three is not okay, actually. So you shouldn't be surprised that at some level you will hit some ambiguity in your calculation, and that's what's going on here. There is a paper by Garage and Preston, in the 80s, I believe, discussing exactly this point, having delta functions in your stress energy tensor and how well defined it is. Yeah. So with all this motivation in place, let's look at how to set up the calculation itself. And so we're doing an expansion about flat space. And since we're doing gravity here, then we had better have our Einstein-Hilbert action. And then we need to find a way to describe the dynamics of our compact objects. And in fact, this is where the assumption that we have that these compact objects can be approximated as point particles come in very crucially. In fact, what we mean by a point particle at the level of the action is simply that the gravitational degrees of freedom interacting with the compact objects are localized on some row line that these point masses sweep out. But otherwise, the only other constraint is that of symmetry, which means to say, if you want to form an action for a compact object, you need to write down all possible scalar functionals that you can build out of geometric tensors, the d velocities of these point masses, perhaps their spin at some level, maybe the multipole tensors in describing the internal structure of these objects, and so forth. And once you've enumerated all possible scalar functionals that you can build, you integrate them with respect to proper time of these point masses, and there you go, you have the action of these compact objects. But if you think about it for a second, you realize that there's obviously an infinite number of ways you can write down such scalars. So what I'm telling you, at least at the formal level, is that to describe the dynamics of a compact object, and approximate it as a point particle, you really need an infinite number of terms in your action. So you're going to ask me, surely at this point, what good is it to have an infinite number of terms to describe a compact, just a single compact object? And the answer is that actually the point particle approximation really gives us computational control, because what we're doing here is really perturbation theory. So formally, we have an infinite series, but this infinite series can always be truncated based on how much physics you want to include. Do you want to include effects from the rotation of these compact objects? Do you want to include effects from the multipole tensors describing the internal structure, and so forth? So to be concrete, for example, if you look at the minimal term that I've written down here, the MDS term, it's just describing for you a structureless point mass. Whereas the other non-minimal terms that I'm writing down, in particular over here, most likely describe the tidal effects occurring, acting upon your compact objects, because you see the Riemann curvature tensor here. And so to give physical meaning to these non-minimal terms, what you need to do is basically fix the numerical coefficients of these guys here. And to do that, what we usually do is called a matching procedure in the field, which is, I think, best described, best explained by a specific example. So for example, if you consider a bunch of non-rotating black holes that's going around each other, and what you want to do is first start from a Schwarzschild metric and compute some physical observable from it. For example, maybe consider scattering gravitational waves off your Schwarzschild metric and extracting, say, the partial wave amplitudes. And then try to do the similar calculation using these terms over here. And once you've decided how accurate you need your answer to be, you find that you can tune these coefficients until the two answers from both sides will match up. And this same calculation will also tell you basically how many terms, how many non-minimal terms you need. For the purposes of my talk, I'm actually only going to do the calculation with the minimal term. And as far as the consistency of the theory is concerned, meaning you don't have to add counter terms to this, you can show that it is okay up to 4 p.m. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my talk, which is that I'm going to work Einstein-Hilbert plus my minimal point particle action. Now, actually, we are sort of in business. You have an action. You can now stick it into your path integral. And here, this is where field theory gives us a computational framework, because the effective action that we are after is simply given as a perturbative expansion by the sum of all fully connected Feynman diagrams. And the only catch here is that because we're doing a classical problem, we're not doing quantum gravity here, therefore you only need to keep the tree diagrams. You don't have any graviton loops, for example. But if you just take a moment and think about what you have over here, you find that actually by themselves, these guys would already give you an infinite number of terms. For a flat space expansion, you have, because of the nonlinear nature of Einstein-Hilbert, you get an infinite number of graviton self-interactions. And just the Taylor series from the square root over here would also give you, an infinite number of terms. So you need an organizing principle to help you figure out what you really need. And that organizing principle is called dimensional analysis. And this dimensional analysis is just simply based on what physical scales exist in your problem. And there aren't that many at this order, at least. There's little r, which is the typical separation between your bodies. And there's v, the typical speed of these point masses. And from there, you can form the ratio r over v, which is just the typical orbital time scale of your system. And so, for example, whenever you see a time derivative or a time delta function, you want to say that, oh, that scales like v over r. If you see a volume integral like that, you want to say that scales like this particular combination of r and v. The other thing that I've already alluded to is that the post-Newtonian program is really, schematically at least, a power series in v squared, where the lowest order term is simply the Newtonian action, which I'm going to call S naught. And what you find is that as you do the calculation, there will be explicit factors of V showing up that will help you in your dimensional analysis. But there will be implicit factors if you assume that your system is virialized, which means that the Newtonian potential energy we're basically this guy over here, the potential has to scale like V squared coming from the kinetic energy. The other very important ingredient, because it's a field theory calculation, is the graviton propagator itself. And the reason why it's important, it will tell you how the graviton field itself would scale. Because if you remember, how do you get Feynman diagrams? You take terms in your action, you multiply them together, and then you consider all possible weak contractions between the graviton fields, where each contraction between a pair of graviton fields will give you one factor of your graviton propagator. So if you want to know how H itself scales, how the field itself scales, you want to first look at the dimensionful quantities in the graviton propagator that actually I've written down in the non-relativistic limit. And then you basically want to take the square root of that guy, and that is how you get this expression over here. If you take a space derivative, you take away one power of r, and if you take a time derivative, you add one power of v. And with all that, you find that every Feynman diagram that you can possibly draw would have to scale like some power of the Newtonian action multiplied by some power of v squared. And in fact, it's a classical problem, so this guy has to be necessarily 1. And then the exponent over here of v squared would tell you precisely which order in the post-Newtonian program you're working at. So this dimensional analysis tells you exactly which terms in your action and which Feynman diagrams you need to really do your calculation. But not only that, dimensional analysis actually tells you a little bit more, which is that actually there is a limited form of superposition that continues to hold, even though the theory is nonlinear. And the reason is that if you look at the exponent of v squared here, you find that it only depends on the total number of particles in a given diagram. So in particular, if you're looking at, say, the Q post-Newtonian order, what you find is that you will have at most Q plus 2 distinct particles in your diagram, which means if you evaluated your diagrams keeping all the 2 distinct particles all the way up to Q plus 2 distinct particles, then from there on, basically superposition carries over to arbitrary number of particles. So for example, at 1 pn, the n-body problem is really the 3-body problem. At 2 pn, v to the 4th, the n-body problem is really the 4-body problem, and so forth. So with all that aside, we can now look at some results. At lowest order, we should obviously recover Newtonian gravity. Here, A and B are the labels of my point particles. These guys are the indices of my graviton fields. RAB is just the Euclidean distance between the A-th particle and the B-th particle. If you go to the next order, these are the diagrams, and you sum them up, and you get the Einstein, Infeld, Hoffman, Lagrangian at 1 pn. Basically, the diagrams can be sort of split into two categories. One, I will just call these guys over there, are what gives you these terms over here in the Lagrangian, are what I will call relativistic corrections to Newtonian gravity. And then there are these nonlinear terms that basically gives you one of our squared gravitational potentials. And in fact, amongst them, you start seeing the nonlinearities of gravity itself showing up, because these guys are the 3 graviton self-interactions. And what I want to highlight also, if you look at these terms over here, the 3-body interactions, I don't know if the back can see, but for example, if you look at this term over here, you find that now the gravitational force between, say, particle A and particle B not only depends on the radial distance between A and B, as we're familiar from Newtonian gravity, but it also now depends on the distance between A and C. So this is a reflection of the nonlinear nature of the gravitational force. The other piece of physics that's worth noting is that there is, if you remember in Newtonian gravity, there is a vector called the Runge-Lenz vector, which is a constant within Newtonian gravity. It lies in the plane of the two-body problem, the plane defined by the two-body problem in Newtonian gravity. And what you find is that if you take its time derivative and substitute the equations of motion that you will get out of this guy over here, you find that's what exactly gives you the precession of the perihelion of planetary orbits. Now let's go to the second order diagrams, split them into whether or not they contain graviton self-interactions. Many of them are relativistic corrections to the lower order diagrams that you saw, but some of them do also give you new 1 over r cubed gravitational potentials. And amongst them, you do start seeing, again, new interactions amongst the new self-interactions of the gravitons. For example, this is the 4 vertex here. This is the contraction between the 2-3 graviton vertices, which actually are the most difficult to evaluate at this order. These are the three-body diagrams. They are really a subset of what you just saw, except that now you have 3 distinct particles instead of 2. And then finally, you have four-body interactions. And then if you have the energy to crank through the integrals, this is your effective Lagrangian. These guys here are the two-body interactions, three-body interactions, and the four-body interactions. Let's look at it a little more closely. If you want to convince yourself that this is indeed a 2PN Lagrangian, you just count the explicit factors of V over here. You find that this is V to the 4, these terms over here, times basically Newtonian gravity. And here you get 2 factors of V's, but if you decompose this guy, you find that it is G Newtonian gravity times Gm over R. And if you remember your Virial theorem, that's a factor of V squared. So again, that's a 2PN term. And likewise, over here, you can do your Virial theorem and convince yourself that indeed you have a 2PN Lagrangian. And then these are the three-body interactions. I just want to point out that you again see the nonlinear nature of the gravitational force, because you see this this term over here involves the sum of the Euclidean distance between all the 3 particles in your system. And finally, you have your four-body interactions. And I want to point out, and I was speaking to Misha just now about this problem, I want to point out that actually there is a remaining integral in this n-body problem that has yet to be evaluated. And it occurs in both the four-body interactions as well as the three-body interactions that you see over here. And the integral basically looks like this guy over here. So if anyone enjoys doing crazy dimensionally integrated, regulated integrals like this, maybe we can write a follow-up paper together. Okay, so let me just spend the last few minutes browsing through the third-order diagrams. They're mainly relativistic corrections to the lower-order diagrams, but there are new interactions coming in at the level of the five-point functions. There's the 5 graviton self-interaction. There's the contraction between the 3 and the 4, and so forth. So let me end by looking at what lies ahead in this n-body program. You notice I've not included rotation of these compact objects. I've not included effects from the multipole moments, for example. And I've not also described what is the pattern of radiation that would be generated by this n-body system. Regarding the higher post-Newtonian part of the calculation, There are different things that we can try. For example, Misha has introduced these different set of variables to parametrize each mu nu, and that's something that is worth trying out at higher PNs. There is also a different gravitational Lagrangian that was computed using string-inspired methods that I think is worth looking into. And along the same spirit, I see a lot of development regarding non-abelian gauge theory and gravitational scattering amplitudes in the recent years based on recursion relations obeyed by these endpoint functions. The thing about these are, those are for on-shell amplitudes. So my question is, if there are string theorists in the audience, is whether are there similar or at least a limited form of these recursion relations that will hold for off-shell amplitudes, because that's highly relevant to this post-Newtonian program. And finally, I think I need to write some more code. And so with that, thank you for listening to my talk. Any questions? Yes.
Okay, so you mentioned that there, in your method, you need to assume things are variableized.
Uh-huh, yes, yes.
And how important is that constraint?
Yeah, because the power counting, the dimensional analysis, that I want to say GM over R scales like V squared, that is important. Right? Otherwise, I cannot claim that the Lagrangian I showed you, for example, this guy here, I cannot claim that this is a 2PN Lagrangian. In fact, what would it even mean? Right? For example, you know, this term over here, especially, there's no explicit factors of velocity here, and you can ask me, if it's not virialized, I can no longer claim that is a perturbative thing. Right?
So is that a strong constraint if we're worried that it's mm-hmm. It limits your application quite a lot, because if I want to study, like, say, a comet captured by the sun, or two halos merging.
Yeah, I think the calculation can still be carried through, but I think there'll be a need to organize the calculation a bit differently. There might be a different parameter that you're using as an expansion parameter. So I think it'll come down to a case-by-case basis. But it is true, but... I think the limit here at the practical level, I think it's more of the weak field limit. So if you want to go, if your black holes come very, very close to each other, and you want to see how do the horizons blend and merge into each other, then certainly it's well beyond the validity of what I'm doing here. So I think the fundamental constraint here is that I'm doing an eta plus h expansion, where, you know, so by assumption, h needs to be small, otherwise perturbation theory is not valid. But otherwise, this v squared constraint, I think, can be relaxed. I think it can. Yes?
How does this Hamilton or Lagrangian for the, say, for the second order case, how does it compare to the system of equations we get from the Hamiltonian system that Schaeffer derived?
Right.
Is it the same, or are they...
I think they have to be equivalent. They have to be equivalent. I did not...
they are the same.
Yeah.
They're also getting more computed 2PM Lagrangian within this formalism, and they compare, and these are precisely the same.
Precisely.
2PM, yes.
So what I wanted to say was also that I think what I did do was that so they had a Lagrangian also, which I assume is equivalent to whatever Hamiltonian they got. Mm-hmm. And at this order, at least, it's been known for a while. So when I finished this calculation, my check was to basically make sure that this Lagrangian that I got can be matched onto the Lagrangian they got.
So
if their Lagrangian is the same as the Hamiltonian, then mine is the same as their Lagrangian. Yeah. You just basically it comes down to doing a coordinate transformation. So the expression won't look identical right away. I think that might be what you're asking. But once you do a coordinate transformation of your axis here, the external, the coordinates of these point masses, then you can find a coordinate transformation that will bring one Lagrangian into another one, up to possibly a total time derivative.
Just to clarify, so yes, the divergences that appear in the post-Newtonian calculations, mm-hmm, to third order, mm-hmm, and beyond, mm-hmm, you're encountering those in your 3PM calculations?
Yeah, so I will, if I start cranking through these diagrams here, yes, I believe so. And then supposedly dimensional regularization should be able to take care of it. But yes, at this order, so this is why I think it is an interesting problem if someone can actually sit down and crank through these, you know, diagrams and make sure that just purely from the field theoretic framework we get the same answer. I think it will be a good thing to do, but of course you can see it is a huge undertaking. Yeah.
Presumably the dimensional regularization is going to bring in an extra degree of complication to the calculation apart from the actual.
By complication, you mean?
Well, is that going to pose any technical difficulties?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly the integrals are hard. I assume that the integrals are going to be quite hard. But at least for the two-body problem, you see, you know that the only invariant there is RAB, the Euclidean distance between A and B. So it's not like the n-body problem where you get these, once you get to higher and higher post-Newtonian order, the number of invariants you get increase. In fact, proliferates quite a bit, right? This is a three-body problem. You have three of them here. For the four-body, you have basically four choose two. Five-body, you have five choose two, and so on. So that will be the technical difficulty if I want to pursue my n-body program for higher orders. That will be the case, but I think what's most pressing at the third order is to try to make sure that the two-body results are right or match up with the rest of the calculation that has been already done. And there, I think it will be hard, but it should be doable.
Well, that's good, because I talked to Kevin Schaefer one time, and he told me that the third order three-body Hamiltonian would never be written down.
Hmm. So, why is that so? What?
He just said the inner integrals that nobody knew how to do.
Okay. Yeah. So he might be three body. Okay. Okay.
You mentioned that the divergence comes from the fact you have point particles.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I would imagine one intuitive way to do so would be just introduce another scale, the size of particle.
Uh-huh.
Also expand around that scale.
Right.
Why we're not doing that, but instead we're looking for some regularization?
So at some level you will be obliged to. So remember I wrote down and essentially I made quite explicit that at least formally you have an infinite series of terms to describe the dynamics of a compact object. And the reason, the physical reason for doing that is because at some level the finite size, the internal structure of your object matters. Gives you gravitational effects. So you have to, at some point, there will be new scales in the problem, whether is it coming from the multiple moments of your internal object and internal structure, or maybe the spin and so on. There will be new scales. It's just that what I've done so far is just work with the minimal term, and there are no scales except for the masses themselves. The regularization that is encountered is because, as I've alluded to earlier already, is that intrinsically having a three powers of your delta function in your TMU, that is in itself not very well defined. So.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if you introduce a finite size, then you don't have to regular function.
Sure, sure.
Then presumably you don't have the divergence.
Anymore. Sure. I think what you're saying. Yeah.
This is exactly why you do not introduce finite size.
Well, I would say consider regularization here is also extremely difficult. at least
the dimensional organization is not extremely difficult. Maybe to do some integral, but it's clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you introduce some finite size.
So you can have an expansion, that's also clear.
But you have to care about Lorentz and Lyon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not suggesting to find the entire structure of that object. Just give me a characteristic size of that object, and you expand around it. Just one Etruscan in the system. If I can solve the divergence, I don't.
The way I'm thinking about that is that it's another way of regulating
divergence. Yeah. Like cutting it off. Cut off which is actually in the end often more troublesome. Mm-hmm.
But it is given by the property of your physical system. Because if you give me a group of stars, I can give you the physical size of everything.
I think having a cutoff will break gauge invariance here because we're doing gravity. So I think physically, I get this question a bit. I think physically it's easier to interpret. I think that's what you're alluding to. Having a cutoff tells you, my cutoff is determined by my finite size effects. But then you're going to deal with how to deal with the broken, you will find that your gauge invariance will be probably broken. Yeah.
Let me just say that, so in perturbation theory, in the extreme mass ratio limit, so we used to do it, using renormalization schemes, but Bob Wald in Chicago, they did it by introducing finite size of the volume, taking the limit. I think you have to take the mass scaling down to zero, the same way as the radius of the object. And he did manage to derive the equations in a right way, if you wish. So, certainly in that regime, it has been done successfully.
It's like Weinberg says, you can use any variables you like in a problem, but if you use the wrong ones, you'd be sorry.
Any more questions?
What are you saying? Just make constraints and then do it in 2 sessions later. No problem. You can do it one.